ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 20th of November. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Australian teenagers are waking up to a warning from tech giant Meta that their social media accounts will be deleted in 2 weeks. And they've got a fortnight to download or delete their data on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. A world-first social media ban stopping under 16-year-olds from having accounts kicks in from December the 10th, but the company will start purging accounts from December the 4th as it races to remove more than 500,000 users by the deadline. The ABC's national technology reporter Angela Voipierre joined me earlier. Ange, are Australian teenagers ready for this? Would today's warning be a shock?
I think it might be a bit of a shock to some of them. It's happening about a week earlier than they might have expected. So Meta has started sending out these two-week warnings on email, SMS, within its apps. The message is pretty blunt. It's that there are new laws in Australia, which mean that in 2 weeks you will not have access to this account. There are also instructions there for those young people. Really download and save your posts and messages is the message there, or delete your account. There's also a nudge to provide contact details so that your account can be reactivated once you've turned 16, so Meta can contact you. So Meta taking this moment to try to make sure those users do bounce back eventually. But yes, it is about a week earlier than we possibly expected. The first of these accounts receiving notices today will lose access on December 4, which is a week before the law kicks in. And that's really because of the size of the task. Meta is aiming to remove at least 500,000 accounts across Facebook and Instagram, and it is expecting to contact all those users over the course of the coming week.
Who are getting these warnings, and are there people who should be and aren't?
Yes. So these users who are getting the warning today and, you know, over the coming days, these are the users that Meta is the most confident that they're under 16, but there will be stragglers. So in many cases, the people hearing from Meta this week, they're the ones who've been upfront about their age. They've told Meta their actual age. In other cases, though, it might be because the company's managed to work out they're probably younger than they said they were based on their online activity. Now, my question to a Meta spokesperson was, if you don't get a message this week from Meta, does that mean you're in the clear? And the answer basically is no, you're not out of the woods. The company says it's going to keep improving, reviewing its systems for proactively detecting under 16s. So this is just the first wave. That said, many Australian users, older people, might never hear from them.
Now, we know none of this is fail-safe. What happens to the Meta users who receive a message like this and they're over 16 years old?
Yeah, we've heard some of the detail today about how the appeals process will work for Meta. So if a user has got a message like this, a warning message, they can challenge their removal if they say, well, no, I'm actually over 16, by undergoing facial age scans with a video selfie, that kind of thing, or providing a government-issued ID such as a driver's license. Now, Meta's working with a third-party company called Yoti, which is one of the market leaders. It's got one of the most accurate tools out there, according to independent testing. But the issue with facial age checks is that they do get less accurate at that crucial 16-year threshold, and they can often return false positives, false negatives to the people nearest to the cutoff range. Speaking to Meta yesterday, it is still not clear what recourse will be available to Meta users who are wrongly flagged as under 16 in the first place. So get a warning like this. They're then wrongly blocked by facial age checks. And if they're then unable to provide government ID, it's not clear what the next step for that person would be.
Angela Voipierre there. Consultation with workers over the potential closure of Australia's largest aluminium smelter end tomorrow, with an alliance, including renewable energy organisations and industry groups, appealing for long-term solutions to keep it open. The Tomago plant in the Hunter region in New South Wales is power hungry. Electricity takes up 40% of its running costs. The owner, Rio Tinto, has previously said only a long-term plan delivering cheaper power would keep it open. The federal and New South Wales government have been in talks with the company about how that might stay open, citing the national interest. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
Just north of Newcastle, on the New South Wales coast, you'll find Tomago's aluminium smelter. It produces more than 40% of Australia's aluminium and provides more than 1,000 jobs for the Hunter region. But its future is at risk as its owners try to work out how to deal with astronomical power bills.
My understanding is the Rio board is meeting on Friday, so you would hope they would give workers some type of communication around where the process is at.
Justin Page is the coordinator at the Hunter Jobs Alliance. The smelter is the country's largest electricity user. Energy accounts for 40% of its operating costs. And owner Rio Tinto says it may need to shut down once its contract with AGL expires in 3 years due to rising electricity costs, unless it can find a deal with the help of the state and federal governments.
You know, the governments were looking at short-term bailout proposals, which wouldn't suit Tomago, Rio, all those workers. So hopefully the discussions have progressed on significant long-term proposal to secure affordable power for Tomago to keep continuing into the future.
The Australian Renewable Industry Alliance is also calling for a long-term solution for the smelter's energy future. Tim Buckley is the director of public interest think tank Climate Energy Finance.
I think it is absolutely critical that we acknowledge the importance of Australia's manufacturing sector, our value add of our resource sector in particular, and the enormous opportunity for Australia to help drive decarbonisation of our key trade partners, but also to do value adding in our country. We are a world leading mining export nation. We have to be able to value add our resources to maximise the value for our country and to ensure that we actually pivot as the world embraces decarbonisation.
The ABC has been told the federal government is considering an energy supply deal with the government-owned Snowy Hydro, offering Rio Tinto clean energy at competitive prices. Or the government could sign long-term supply contracts with renewable energy developers and would then on-sell electricity to major users like Tomago.
I see a public-private collaboration to keep Tomago commercially viable and operational in Australia is absolutely in our national interest.
Finding a solution that brings down power prices or industry will take time, and governments will need to convince companies to stay onshore rather than shipping off materials to process elsewhere. Dr. Susan Stone is the Chair of Economics at the University of South Australia.
Most people think we'll get there, but the point is, how long will it take? And in the meantime, the smelter has to compete in international markets.
Just days after the CSIRO announced hundreds of jobs are to be axed, Dr. Stone says it's not about some jobs being more worthy of bailouts, but which will generate the biggest impact.
If the CSIRO spreads those job losses across all of its different activities and all of its different offices, then the impact on any one particular area is less. The problem with something like Tomago is that it has a very concentrated employment impact. So there will be that region, which has, you know, 1,000 jobs, will be more significantly impacted.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Minister for Industry and Science said the government will always put Australian workers and businesses first, and any solution will need to be made collaboratively in partnership with the state government and the facility owner.
Elizabeth Cramsey there. A federal inquiry into PFAS, known as human-made forever chemicals because they take hundreds of years to break down, says there should be urgent action to give the public information about contaminated sites and what's happening to clean them up. The committee's made nearly 50 recommendations, including blood screening for exposed communities. Yet there's still debate in Australia about the chemicals' impact on human health, despite a growing body of international research outlining the risks. Political reporter Romy Stevens filed this report.
It's been almost 18 months since elevated levels of PFAS chemicals were discovered in the Upper Blue Mountains drinking water catchment. John Dee is a local resident and founder of the community group Stop PFAS.
Further testing that the community did found the actual cause of that contamination, which was firefighting foam used in a petrol tanker crash back in 1992.
Blood tests from some residents show some PFAS levels higher than averages in the nation's most contaminated communities. countries. PFAS, or forever chemicals as they're commonly known, are a group of synthetic chemicals that persist for long periods in the environment. They are used in various products such as non-stick cookware and firefighting foam. John Dee says the community feels let down by the response since the discovery.
The government will not give us free blood tests, so we're being left in the dark about the impact on us.
A Senate inquiry has made 47 recommendations to help tackle PFAS contamination and risk mitigation in communities like the Blue Mountains. One of them is providing subsidised blood testing, as well as enhanced health screening and mental health support for highly exposed groups. That's been welcomed by John Dee.
Many communities cannot afford the $500 cost of a PFAS blood test. And our view is, if a government agency, like a firefighting agency or a water agency, has contaminated your drinking water, then we should not have to pay anything.
The report also recommends reviewing and strengthening health guidance and safe exposure levels. Over 12 months, the committee heard a range of views on the health effects of PFAS exposure. Bernard Stewart is a professor in the Faculty of Medicine and Health at the University of New South Wales.
There is clear evidence that PFAS may present a carcinogenic risk. It is not definitively established.
Do you agree that we need more research to find out the links between PFAS and cancer and if they exist?
There is an established burden of lung cancer due to atmospheric pollution in this country. And if I were doing research, I would put that matter ahead of investing in PFAS research, because in respect of environmental pollution and lung cancer, the burden of disease is established, whereas in respect to PFAS, it's still an open question.
The federal government has invested almost $12 million into research to better understand the potential health effects from PFAS exposure. PFAS Select Committee Chair and Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe says both the government and regulators have taken decades to act.
There's certainly some action that needs to be taken. The evidence is there. It's been there for decades.
The Senate inquiry has also called for the full phase-out of PFAS-containing firefighting foams and for PFAS to be classified as a dangerous good. The chair of Toxics Free Australia, Jane Bremmer, wants that to go further.
The very nature of PFAS is that it's persistent and bioaccumulative. That is why we need a ban on the full range, the full group of chemicals, and why there is no safe level of exposure to PFAS.
She's particularly concerned about the report referencing the presence of PFAS in synthetic turf.
Who crawls around on synthetic turf? Our children and babies. You know, where's the standards to protect their health?
A spokesperson says the government will now give consideration to the findings of the Senate inquiry report and respond in due course.
Romy Stevens there. An alleged rape victim has written to Wollongong University's Vice-Chancellor urging him to reconsider a Hunger Games redundancy process at a student support service. Universities across the country are preparing for a new national code that requires them to prevent gender-based violence and crack down on sexual harassment on campus. Here's National Education and Parenting reporter Connor Duffy.
The letter from a student credits the University of Wollongong's Student Support Service, Safe and Respectful Communities, SARC, with helping her seek justice. But now the university is proposing that 10 SARC staff will have their roles disestablished and face having to compete for jobs in a new structure. The letter warned the university proceeding with the plan tells victims they don't matter and describes SARC as a lifeline. The president of the University of Wollongong Student Association, Hansel Jude Padore, says many students share the concerns and have been protesting as part of a campaign called Save SARC.
It's very shameful. It sends the message that student safety at UW is disposable. It's difficult to say how they can rebuild trust.
Staff too are fighting the move. NTEU branch president Professor Susan Engel says this is the third redundancy round in 18 months and estimates staff numbers have fallen by 10% across the university.
I think the long-term effect now, that what we're seeing now, is just despondency, that staff have given up on the institution to a degree.
Shana Brenma from End Rape on Campus says SARC is a highly valued service that has seen the number of disclosures of gender-based violence increase exponentially. She warned that trust is now at risk if the service is diminished.
Trust is really eroded when people don't feel safe. And when they don't feel safe to disclose, and when they see a service that they had trust in being removed from them, that's something that You can't rebuild in a hurry.
A new national code passed by the Albanese government comes into force on January 1 next year and requires institutions to proactively prevent gender-based violence. Ms. Brenmar says universities across Australia need to be working to improve services for students and staff experiencing gender-based violence.
This code is game-changing. It's actually life-saving for a lot of students. We know that a lot of the students that do experience gender-based violence don't only stop engaging with their education, they actually become incredibly unwell.
A final decision about the support service is due by the end of the month, and the staff and students are hoping their advocacy will lead to the university reconsidering. In a statement, a University of Wollongong spokesperson said no final decisions had been made, and a revised change proposal to be released next week incorporated feedback from victim survivors. It said the current proposal would not reduce overall staff members and that it was potentially misleading to assume outcomes for particular positions. The spokesperson also said the university is committed to staff and students feeling safe, that it hoped to improve the service and would work with staff and students to make sure it got the final plan right.
Connor Duffy. Reaching the top in any professional sport is a long and arduous journey. In team sports like Australian rules footy and rugby league, coaches and clubs are looking for much more than sporting talent in the young men and women they want to recruit. The AFL draft is currently underway, and Isabel Massali gives us an insight into what it's like to be part of this process.
With pick one, the West Coast Eagles select Willem Dersma from the Gippsland Power.
Surprising no one in the football world, the Eagles snapped up the talented teenager from country Victoria. Willem Dersma now becomes the fourth member of his family to join the league across the men's and women's competitions. He spoke to AFL media moments later while other hopefuls awaited their fate.
You dream about it at the moment of you getting picked up, and you think of getting around to all your family and friends, and especially like Yaz and Xavier. But until it's actually there and it was real, I think that that was probably the most special part, and I really enjoyed it.
How many times at Christmas dinner are you going to bring up the fact that you are the highest drafted Dersma in the household?
I already gave it to him on the way up here, so yeah, we'll see how many times I have to.
It's been a year since Luca Grego went through the same life-changing experience. The now 19-year-old was drafted by the West Coast Eagles at pick 48. He remembers his Melbourne living room being packed with nervous loved ones.
My name was called out, just my first name, and everyone started going absolutely wild. So we don't actually know if it was me at the time. Luckily it was.
What happened next was a pretty fast turnaround, saying as many goodbyes as he could before packing up and landing in Perth just a couple days later.
Lots of friends and teammates that have been picked before me who've sort of given me a little bit of advice, and that was just to take it day by day and have a bit of fun. Although it is our full-time job, it is a fun full-time job, so don't take it for granted and have a bit of fun with it.
While some of those picked at the top end of the draft will slot straight into the AFL, for most it's just the start of a long journey into the senior side. Luca Grego has played one AFL game so far. He says this year's crop need to keep an eye on their long-term future.
It's your first year, you're meant to make mistakes, and you're not meant to play AFL straight away. If you are lucky enough to, then that's awesome. But use it as a year to develop and make sure that you can keep your name on a list for as long as you can.
For many years, former Gold Coast Suns coach Guy McKenna saw the other side. He describes it as a long process that assesses not just technical ability, but character too.
You know, the recruiters and the team psychologists and list managers and stuff like that, they would have interviewed teachers, parents, players, multiple times. I always say that the coach ends up looking at the highlights tape. I'm a little bit different, so I used to always ask the recruiters, okay, when the side's not going well or he's not going well, how do they function? What do? Do they shut down? Do they keep having a go?
And most draftees have just finished high school and still live at home. Guy McKenna's been advocating for the draft age to be raised by a year.
The emotional growth would be enormous. I'd take a lot of pressure off the AFL clubs rather than just pinching him out at home as an 18 and having experienced work and attending things like that. And then the physical maturity of actually then up against playing men in a senior competition in their local states. I think that helps them as well.
The draft continues tonight.
Isabel Massali reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
Donald Trump resisted it for so long, but after a massive U-turn earlier this week, the remaining Epstein files are set to be released. The US House of Representatives overwhelmingly voted in favour of a bill to force the release of the documents. Today, David A. Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic, on how Trump was backed into a corner. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.